Well, our next case is 083358, Bruce S. Smith versus Sandra Sterling Allah. Me, right? How are you, Mr. Jesser?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good
Very
morning.
Fine. Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Stephen H. Jesser, J-E-S-S-E-R, representing Dr. Bruce S. Smith. I'd like to take a different tact in oral argument, if I might, because the Court is always so utterly prepared, maybe my few minutes might be better spent in addressing any of the Court's concerns or questions, because there isn't really much I can add to my written argument, Your Honors, given the rather straightforward circumstances here.
Well, you know, it would seem that Tidwell and Sterling Allah didn't receive adequate notice of Smith's second bankruptcy petition. Their attorney only received notice shortly before Christmas. There was little time left at that point for the attorney to investigate the bankruptcy, take appropriate action before the bar date in January. So how shall we deal with that?
Yes, Your Honor, there's no way that I would or could spin that, and that is unfortunate. It's unfortunate Mr. Robinson didn't have much notice, but his office did have requisite notice of the second bankruptcy through a motion filed by Johnson and Bell concerning the state court actions. It was unfortunate Mr. Robinson was on vacation during some of that time, but he returned from vacation before the hearing.
But they didn't have the 60-day period, though, that they normally would have had. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And their period would be much compressed. At the best reading of it, they had maybe 20 days?
Yes, Your Honor. Our contention is that all of this is unfortunate, but it does not rise to the level of fraudulent concealment, intentional fraud by Dr. Smith or his attorney, Mr. Sin.
What about the first
motive? Didn't the doctor have a motive here with?
I believe that Judge Schmetterer overstated the motive, that because Dr. Smith was uninsured, as he was, that he had a higher motivation to lie and prevaricate or to put.
Try to run it through without giving.
Yes, and if he were insured. I've never been sued, but even if I had what I felt was adequate insurance, I would worry terribly about any lawsuit. So I don't believe the existence or not of professional liability insurance is that much of a factor here.
Was the bankruptcy judge wrong in considering the fact that there had been similar conduct by the same party in 2004 in his filings, in his first bankruptcy?
Know what similar conduct.
Well, apparently he'd done the same thing. He put some creditors on the. Not sure what the form was, but it's a form that is not the one that gets notice. And he'd done the same. Really, what he'd done was the same thing in 2004 they did here.
I'm sorry, Judge. I frankly don't recall.
I'd have to run through the thing real quick to find where I'm talking about. Go ahead with your argument.
I basically stated my argument, Your Honor, that there was testimony adduced before Judge Schmetterer by Mr. Sin, the attorney who prepared the bankruptcy petition, working in a high-volume bankruptcy law office, fighting the pressure of a newly revised bankruptcy act, turning these out, unfortunately, like a mill, and putting Ms. Tidwell and Ms. Sterling Allah on the wrong form. Unfortunate, sloppy, all of that, but not, in our view, fraudulent.
Well, look. You know, I mean, maybe a different fact finder could have found that failure to list Tidwell and Sterling Allah was a simple mistake rather than fraud. But in what sense do the facts absolutely preclude Judge Schmetterer's finding that this was, in fact,
I can only contend, Your Honor, that Mr. Sin's testimony was cast aside, that Mr. Sin freely admitted that he was careless. And for that matter, Dr. Smith was careless in, as a layperson, not observing that Ms. Tidwell and Ms. Sterling-Ala were listed on the wrong form. I don't know if that's a very good answer, Judge, but that's the best one I have.
Are you blaming the attorney on this one?
It's a shared blame, Your Honor. The attorney should have been more careful, but my client should have been more careful as well.
Again, your client had gone through this before. He'd filed a bankruptcy petition before this.
Yes,
this wasn't his first
bankruptcy petition before. I don't frankly recall what, if any, wrongful conduct he committed in the 04 filing to have led to its dismissal. But that did not preclude him from refiling in 05 just before this deadline.
Well, where he listed this was on a statement of financial affairs instead of on Schedule F, which is secured unsecured creditors.
Yes.
And if he listed it on the unsecured creditors, they would have gotten notice.
That's correct.
And he issued it on F, which means they didn't get notice.
Correct.
And I think that's exactly the same thing he did in 2004. He listed certain unsecured creditors on the Statement of Financial Affairs instead of Schedule F, so they didn't get notice either. Would that be something the judge appropriately could look at as to whether or not
could look at, Your Honor,
there was fraud?
And take into consideration. I have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr.
Chester. Thank you,
Good morning, Mr. Robinson.
Good morning, Justices. Darrell Robinson for the appellees, Trina Titwell and Surgeon Sandra Sterling-Ala, Judge. Obviously, there's two issues, whether or not notice was timely and whether or not facts alleged are fraud, Judge. We think it's an easy case in terms of whether or not notice was adequate, and the Supreme Court has basically said a reasonable time for the person receiving notice to be able to respond and understand what's going on in the particular case. What we'd like the court to understand in this particular case so far, based upon the lower court's research and own research, this case involves the shortest notice ever on record. Yet the appellants maintain that, in fact, that notice was adequate. Now, the court was unwilling to toll notice from December 23rd to January 3rd using the Palmer case, although we disagree with that interpretation. But even if this court was to be maintain that the lower court's interpretation, we still think there's a compelling argument that notice was inadequate. The distinguishing factor is in the Palmer case, the daughter received notice. The individual who the notice was intended for just didn't open the envelope for a period of over a week. In this particular case, the attorney was out of the office. The notice was faxed over on December the 23rd, the afternoon of December the 23rd, almost 3 months after the petition was filed. The attorney then returned to the office on January the 3rd, and as the lower court stated, that's a commonly known downtime for attorneys in a litigation case. And so, unlike in the Palmer case where they say the appellees doesn't get the benefit of taking their time to read their correspondence, there was no one in the office to read that correspondence. But nevertheless, if the court was to agree with the December 23rd date, it's not really 20 days, Judge. It is actually 16 days. And so,
if they had been given notice within the 60-day period, one would assume that somebody would have been in the office during that period of time to have read the mail.
Gave the appellees an opportunity for someone to respond accordingly.
And also, as I understand, the attorney who was representing the appellees was not a bankruptcy attorney?
A personal injury attorney, Judge. All right, so. And obviously, the court says under all the circumstances involved, the lower court has taken consideration to determine whether notice was adequate. So a personal injury attorney would have to find out. In addition, Judge, the notice that was faxed over didn't say anything about the day of discharge, the timing to contest discharge. It was just a motion by the state court. There was never even a notice provided to the attorney by the bankruptcy attorney. It was the state court saying that they were filing a motion to stay a case, interestingly enough, that was scheduled to be discharged in about 2 weeks.
What is the status of the state court action?
The state court action, Judge, is in a pretrial investigation stage. The state court judge is attempting to explore the assets of the appellant in this particular case to determine what action that we should take going forward. The additional discovery is being put on hold, Judge, because there is a Illinois Department of Professional Financial Regulations prosecution going on of the appellant by complaint brought against him on based on similar circumstances, but three unrelated individuals. So that's where the state courts get. So we requested.
So all that in the record?
No, that was filed after this. As far as that is concerned, Judge, but we requested that the judge in the state court case stay it because we've been cooperating with the prosecution to preserve the evidence for testimonial purposes. Now, in terms of the fraud case, Judge, we believe the fraud count, we believe that judges in the lower court, there was enough evidence. And what they stated is substantial abuse in a 2004 bankruptcy that caused it to be dismissed as far as that is concerned. So we were listed in the 2004 bankruptcy as a creditor and received notice. And based upon the attorney who filed this 2005 bankruptcy, even his own testimony, he says he refers to prior Schedule Fs to determine the list of creditors in that particular case. That's one of the more compelling reasons why the lower court determined that there was fraud, because he was able to see the Schedule F. In addition, in the 2005, the appellees in this particular case weren't the only ones left. All the lawsuits listed against the appellees were left out of the schedule of secured creditors and put in the statement of financial affairs. So none of them received notice. At this time, that's the only comments that appellees have.
Thank you. Well, we're fine.
Thank you,
Mr. Jester. Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Case is going to be taken under advisement. We're going to go on to case number 5.